But because there's so much space, like mental space that you've created, it kind of gets to the end of those thought patterns and you just kind of start letting it go, going, yeah, I'm obsessing about that too much. It's not as important as I thought it was. And then new things start to surface. And I find that the new things that automatically surface over those days that you start to transition your thinking into without even consciously trying to do that, that's where the new stuff gets birthed. So, I mean, yeah, that was definitely... Those 4 days were definitely sort of the start of that channel.
Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dad show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills, and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics and stories that will captivate you and impact your life. If you're an existing listener, then thanks for your ongoing support of the podcast. I'm really grateful to you for diving into the conversations I'm having. If you've just discovered the podcast, then welcome to the show. Check back through the past episodes, as I'm sure there will be some that pique your interest. To you guys, the dads that listen, you motivate and inspire me to forge ahead with Guild of Dads and help as many dads as I can through the conversations I have. There are a couple of ways that you can get involved with the Guild of Dads movement. You can reach out to me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also join our rapidly growing Facebook group and join the Guild. Over in there, you will find a positive, encouraging community of other dads on life's journey. I'm pleased to say that my message is resonating, a message of personal growth and brotherhood and celebrating men and dads, along with the far-reaching impact we can have on society. I'm proud to be on this journey with you guys and leading this movement. So what do you get on this podcast? Each week, we deliver content and conversations that will expand what you think is possible for yourself, enabling you to positively impact all areas of your life and the lives of those that surround you. We do this by speaking to fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs and ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, and also some ordinary dads like you doing some extraordinary and impactful things. Every episode will give you either actionable resources to take away or a different perspective on a particular topic. These conversations are important and necessary because the world is changing. The role of dads and men is constantly under the spotlight, sometimes under attack. And my dream is to make Guild of Dads the go-to resource for dads like you who want to make some changes in your life and live lives with vision, action, and meaning. Today's episode is about finding meaning through creating. Now, if you're a dad, you'll understand this notion. You will have even helped to create one of the most meaningful things for fathers, which is your children. But what about all the other things in life that we create? And how does the creation of things give life its meaning? Maybe you like creating music. Maybe it's woodwork, sculpting, photography, or dance. And today's episode is about this very subject, how we create meaning in the making. Today I speak to photographer, filmmaker, and author, and philosopher, Sean Tucker. Sean has told visual stories through stills and video for individuals and corporations across 20 different countries, and his popular YouTube channel inspires creatives and non-creatives also. His passion is finding beauty in the ordinary. He's also recently released his book, The Meaning in the Making, and it's that book we delve into on today's episode. And now to my conversation with Sean Tucker. Sean, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on. I checked out your book recently, and it's going to be coming out in September, I know, which is The Meaning in the Making, the Why and How Behind Our Human Need to Create. And I was drawn to the book first and foremost because of the subject title. Meaning is something that kind of interests me, and it's part of what I do at Guild of Dads, but also the mention of logos and the contents. And delving into your work, it really does kind of focus on the whole aspect of the experience and kind of being present in life. What was the inspiration for you behind actually writing the book in the first place?
It had kind of been on my mind for a while, really. I think I've been on a long journey from, you know, I studied psychology at university. And then I went on to study theology and get ordained and work as a pastoral priest for or my 20s, and then left the church when I turned 30. And then there was kind of a five-year period where I was trying to build up a career as a photographer and a filmmaker, which took a while. But when I felt like that was starting to get on more solid footing, I kind of looked around and wondered if I could reclaim some of the good stuff I've lost with the church, because some of the stuff I loved doing was talking to a room full of people and hopefully inspiring them to kind of hack their lives a bit better, to think about who they are a bit deeper, to challenge themselves and the stuff that needed challenging, all that kind of stuff. And I work mostly with sort of 35-year-olds and under, so there's a lot of kind of youth work and teenagers and young adults. And then that's when I sort of decided maybe to give a YouTube channel a go. And I sort of jumped into that at the start. Had a bit of a false step, because the first few videos I put out were very kind of just straight ahead tutorial stuff, which did all right. They were like on how to photograph big products in a studio, which there weren't a lot of videos on, but I and they got passed around a bit because they filled that gap, but I didn't really care about those videos when I watched them back. I'm like, well, it's good info, but it doesn't say anything meaningful. And then I made a video about a year later. I did what everyone does, is you start a few videos and then you abandon the channel because you think like, no, I've made a mistake. It's like the New Year's resolution thing. Funny enough, it was in January 2015 and I just canned it after that month. I'm like, nah, this isn't going to work. And then I came back to it middle of 2016 and I took a trip to Snowdonia just to get away from work, because my day job was like shooting products, which can be very dry and technical. And so I thought, let me go try landscape photography, because I'm crap at that. I have no idea what I'm doing, but maybe by throwing myself in the deep end on something, I'll kind of sink or swim, and I'll have to discover stuff fast, and it will refresh my creativity around this thing I like. And I thought, well, let me film it. Let me film me trying to do this. I'm away for 4 days on my own anyway, and I like doing something creative with my spare time. And let me show me messing this up, but how good it is for me on a creative level. And I posted that video when I got back, and that had a completely different reaction to it. And I cared about it differently. It felt more like what I used to do with the church, which was tell hopefully honest and vulnerable stories about my life and where I got things right and where I got things wrong, that helped other people get honest about their own blind spots and mistakes and help them make better decisions going forward. And I thought, this is a good thing. This, if I keep this tone going, I'm almost reclaiming preaching, but in a secular way. Mm-hmm. And maybe using it to talk about philosophy and psychology rather than trying to convert people to anything. So I did that for a few years. And while I was doing that, I've got like a few different playlists on my channel. There's kind of a tutorial playlist, and then there's a street photography playlist and a portrait playlist. And then there's a featured photographer's playlist where I'm doing documentaries with other photographers. And then there's this philosophical playlist, which I know from feedback from people who follow the channel is followed by a lot of people who aren't photographers or filmmakers, but just because they like the advice. And it applies to all of life. And for me, that was confirmation that, because that's the stuff I really cared about, that there was something in that that was important to me and connecting with other people. So I thought, what if I tried to consolidate all that down and then added a ton of my own stories to it and dug a lot deeper than I can ever go on a video and turn that into a book? So I was kind of sketching out an outline for a book, probably for the last couple of years, about 2 years ago. Then at the beginning of last year, probably in May last year, I was approached by a publisher in the US who said, do you want to do a book? And it just happened. I had this outline, plus the writing was on the wall that we were about to go into lockdown. And I thought, you know, I've been procrastinating about sitting down actually writing this thing. This is kind of all coming together perfectly. I've got to go into my flat and close the door for a few months, and I'm being offered to publish this. So it was a perfect opportunity just to sit down and crack through this and like consolidate down all that stuff that I've been sort of saying for years, but do it much sort of more comprehensively and add a lot more of my own stories to it.
Yeah. And you mentioned that trip to Snowdonia. Do you think that the kind of the influence of nature took what you were doing from a kind of technical level to a more reflective and meaningful level, where you were actually kind of pausing in nature and actually thinking about the impact of what you were doing and the process of it and the imagery that you're capturing? Do you think that kind of became like a bit of a turning point for you in some respects?
It was more about the space, I think. It's any time I take a few days away, even if wherever I'm going isn't particularly naturally beautiful, although that definitely helps. It's just taking deliberate space away, like stepping out of your daily run of things, letting go of the routine. And that's what really helps. Cause then I find that you kind of slide into, your brain almost goes into like a subconscious autopilot, and you start ticking through all the things you've been obsessing about, but because there's so much space, like mental space that you've created, it kind of gets to the end of those thought patterns and you just kind of start letting it go, going, yeah, I'm obsessing about that too much. It's not as important as I thought it was. And then new things start to surface. And I find that the new things that automatically surface over those days that you start to transition your thinking into without even consciously trying to do that, that's where the new stuff gets birthed. So, I mean, yeah, that was definitely that. Those 4 days were definitely sort of the start of that channel. Actually, I remember when I started sketching out the book as well. So the broad outlines of the book was actually when I'd taken a few days away, 5 days away in Iceland. It was my birthday at the time, and my ex had booked us a trip to Iceland for 5 days to go stay in a cabin in the middle of nowhere. And then unfortunately her grandmother died. She had to return to South Africa for that. So I ended up going on my own to Iceland. And that was when I started, you know, again, that sort of subconscious churning through of things. I'm obsessing about X, Y, or Z back home. And then you get to the end of those on day two or three. And then it's like, how about a book? And then you pull out a notepad, you start sketching something down, and that's when the new stuff comes out. I don't think in the daily run of our lives, I don't think we give ourselves enough mental space to generate that stuff. And I talk about it a little bit in the book, that creating that space is like, it's like the in-breath, you know, when you, even if you take the word inspiration, you know, it's got spiration in there, like respiration. It's about breathing, and it's about breathing in. It's about taking in a breath. But I use the example of when I was after high school, I did a year, like a gap year, mm-hmm. where part of a music and drama group, and singing was a big part of that. And I could sing, but I always had this thing when I was a teenager and sort of at the time where like my voice would crack a lot, which is obviously like super humiliating on a stage, you know, in the middle of a song. And I told the singing teacher at the time, I said to him, like, I'm just terrified to do this because my voice cracks all the time. And he said, it's not the voice's problem. He says, you don't have enough air supporting the note. So they had this crazy exercise we used to do where they took like a kind of a wooden block sort of about, I don't know, 20 centimeters by 10 centimeters that they actually stuck. We stuck under our diaphragm. So if you're listening, like you can sort of feel your rib cage and it kind of converges at the top at your sternum, and that cavity just underneath your sternum there, we used to stick that wood block in there and then lean against the wall. So you push your body weight on it. But if you press your fingers in there and then you take a breath in, it like pushes out, it's your diaphragm expands outwards. And it was the first time I was conscious of the muscle that needs to fire to create a vacuum to suck air into my lungs. And that's what happens when I breathe in. And it was amazing. Like when I started to support a note I sang with a proper column of air, it was a lot stronger. And I feel like with our creative lives, the way that so many of us are going, oh, I don't know what to make, but I want to make something. I'm such a creative person. I just don't really know what to point this at. It's because we're trying to sing without first drawing in air. We're trying to make a noise, but there's nothing supporting it yet. And the breathing in, the inspiration, like the literal breathing in, is taking that mental space, is like turning the phone off and going away for a couple of days or just taking yourself for regular walks so you can refresh and actually process things, because that's where inspiration actually comes from, the ideas actually generate, is that empty mental space that we make for ourselves. But we're so busy jumping from, you know, meeting to phone call to Skype to dinner to kids, we don't create that space, and we wonder why we don't have any ideas or we're struggling for ideas. So yeah, it's definitely been, nature is great. Like it does help for sure, but that's not the important part for me. The important part is whatever I can do to create that generative mental space. Mm.
Creating that margin, it's kind of like a margin, isn't it, sort of thing. So you've got a bit of a kind of buffer, because I've noticed that, because I do Guild of Dads alongside my kind of day job, and sometimes when there's like a lot of stuff going on, you're almost looking at it, people listening can't see this, but it's kind of like a pint glass that you've kind of got, you know, and your kind of humdrum is up to sort of there, and it's leaving smaller and smaller amount of space at the top of the glass for your creativity to flow. And like one of the things that I do is, if I go for a long walk in the kind of woods and forests at the back of my house, that could range from 45 minutes to an hour and a half or whatever it's going to be. But I find that within sort of 10 to 15 minutes of that walk, all of a sudden stuff that I'm thinking about begins to drop away, and stuff all of a sudden begins to kind of pop out of nowhere. And it's like you say, it's getting into the habit of doing that to kind of recharge your creative batteries, if you like, because when your brain is in non-creative mode, it becomes really difficult to get into that kind of zone, doesn't it? Do you find that in terms of, you know, you talk about a kind of, you talk about in some of your videos about the creative process in terms of wrestling order from chaos. What do you mean by that in terms of how we typically view the world around us, so to speak?
I think we're all scared of things we can't control, and that's almost everything. You know, I think that's human beings right back to the dawn of time. You know, we've always been trying to make sense of things. So before there was the scientific method, there were people who, you know, painted pictures on the wall to try and sort of maybe creating symbols, maybe creating spiritualities to help them make sense of life and death and everything else. Maybe putting up stone circles and trying to pray to gods that would hopefully, you know, heal their sick relative, or because they can't control sickness, or bring better crops next year because they can't control the weather. And they're constantly trying to bargain with the chaotic forces out there and bring order. And I think when we make things, it's our attempt to bring a little order to the chaos. And it's not because we're trying to order everything. It's just, it feels good. It's that creative act. It's being part of, I think in the books I talk about, it's kind of holding back entropy a little bit, you know, like if human beings are, you know, I mean, life moves in the opposite direction to entropy. So the life that we have is a creative force. We get to be part of that. We get to make more things. We get to generate order out of the chaos that will just happen without us touching it. We don't want to leave things as they are to just slowly decay. We want to build things back up. We want to shape things and mold things and forge things and share it with each other as to show each other this creative force. And I think we just, in a very kind of non-specific way, I think we just draw a lot of comfort from that, you know, that we can do that. It's exciting to us. It's interesting to us. And I think it helps us, I suppose it helps us just stave off a little bit of the fear that comes with the fact that we aren't really in control of much, you know. But if we make these little things and share with each other, at least we can sort of remind ourselves of what we are and what we're capable of. And I think we all get a kick out of that. I mean, obviously, then you can go very specific and say that, you know, someone who writes a song about a heartache that they've just been through, maybe that brings a bit of order to the heartache that they have, because it gives them a bit of catharsis to put that down on a page. And then when they share that song with other people in a performance, half the room's crying because they've also been through the same, and it brings them a bit of healing and some order out of the chaos that existed before. So I think on so many levels, the things that we make and that we share with each other do kind of reorder some of the stuff that we don't have any control over. And that makes us smile. You know?
One thing that kind of I thought of when you were talking about that particular thing is in terms of this notion of kind of creating something. Do you think that it's kind of like a one-way street, or do you think it's a two-way street? And what I mean by that is, so for instance, if you're creating something, do you think that there is a meaning to be derived from the actual creation of it, or is it actually in the someone else receiving what you've created, be it art, be it music, be it podcast, be it films? Is it, do you think there's a two-way kind of meaning street there, or is it a one-way meaning street, do you think?
There's endless passages of meaning. I make things because I need meaning first. That's definitely true, but it's only a small part of the story until I share that, and then it brings some meaning to someone else's life. Now that makes me feel even better and makes someone else feel better. Then they might share that with somebody else who they know is going through something really difficult, but they know that thing that I've made might help them. And then that gets passed on. It's all of it, isn't it? Every piece of it, any way you can bring someone a bit of comfort or a bit of order to their existential chaos, that's all good stuff. That's all the stuff that makes me sleep better at night. Honestly, the days when I've made something, and feel like, oh, I did something substantial today. I made something that made me happy today. Already, that's enough to sort of give me a good night's sleep and make me feel like my day wasn't wasted. Mm. And other people experiencing something good or meaning from that is just, and that could go from just, someone smiles for a second, something you do to I've had emails from people who say, hey, I watched a particular video you made and I didn't kill myself because I watched it. And I'm like, well, even if it was just you saying that, my life's work is done. Like, that's a massive, massive thing. If that's true, that's amazing. Mm. And all of that is meaning. It's not just about me making stuff for myself to have it feel good for me. That's just, half the story, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think there is a positive feedback loop in that, isn't there? Because you've got the kind of positive feedback loop that you get when you get feedback from someone about the impact that you've had. But also there is like a ripple effect as well. So you do something, then that changes their kind of trajectory, almost like the butterfly effect. And then that impacts how they behave as well. And this can be on a lot really micro level. And I've spoken to someone about this before. Like, it could be that, I don't know, you go and get a coffee and you get chatting to the barista and they start talking to you about the fact that they work in here a couple of days of the week, but in actual fact their real passion is acting or doing something else. And you say to them, okay, well, why don't you just pursue that a bit more, sort of thing? And then all of a sudden their life trajectory changed because you were that one guy that walked into the coffee shop on a rainy Tuesday afternoon in January, and it was that one little thing that you said to them that push them over the edge to actually go and do that thing that they'd always wanted to do, sort of thing. So all of these things kind of compound in society. And I think that it's really interesting with what's gone on in the last year, that how stuff can compound in a negative way as well as a positive way, can't it? On the sort of subject of that, do you find that there are, you talk about there being like a limit to our kind of descriptive powers about around what we make, and then you say about there that we must weave collective meaning from the kind of creative. And I think we probably just delved into this here, but what do you kind of mean on that kind of thing, that we need to it's like a group thing rather than a kind of individual thing?
Well, this might be a very me thing, but I think art can, anyone who makes anything, art can run the risk of becoming a bit onanistic and very sort of self-centered. And it's me and it's my beautiful thing that I make and I'm an artist, and there's a lot of ego in that and a lot of identity sort of wrapped up in that as well. And I think we do not only other people, but we do ourselves a disservice if we go too far down that road and forget that the point of making things is to share it with each other. I think for me, it certainly is. Like, I don't want to make things and hide them away. I want to make things and share them. I want people to experience things I've made, and I want to use art as communication as well. There are things I think I know about life because of my own experience that I want to tell other people about. So it becomes a medium for a message, whether it's photography in my case or filmmaking or writing. Like, there's things I want to say, and I want to say it with the things that I make. And I think the quote you're referring to, I think I said something like, you know, when we reach the end of our traditional descriptive powers, and by that I mean words, you know, when we try and describe stuff, we'll say it or write it, but sometimes there aren't the words to say what we want to say. And we don't even really understand what we want to say yet, but we have a sense of it. We've kind of intuited something about life. And that, I think, is where various artistic outlets have more language, because it's less literal, for us to try and express what we've intuited about life. So I think a lot of people will say, well, you know, I could never sit and just write an essay about with neat descriptive prose about what I've learned from my father's death. I just don't think I've got that language in me. I don't understand it yet, but I can go and make something that points at it. And maybe by producing some sculpture out of clay, I can express it in that way. And maybe in some ways then that has more impact, even though it's less specific, but more impact for someone else who views that, and you tell them the story about why you made it. Maybe it hits them on some other level as well. So what I mean is various artistic expressions don't need to be as literal as descriptive prose. And it opens up avenues of us being able to communicate what we intuit across the board. And I think that's a lot of people's experiences of what they make, you know, I'm not 100% sure what this piece is about, but I made it after this happened in my life. And that's kind of what I put into it. And, you know, maybe other people get that when they look at it. Maybe they don't. Maybe it was good catharsis for you. Maybe people do get it and it's the same for them. You know, there's no guarantee about the results, but it's definitely some of the reason, I think, why a lot of people gravitate towards making things. And I think all human beings on some level are creative, you know. We all make something, whether it's traditional, you know, painting or music or sculpting, or it's something different. Maybe it's design, and, you know, or maybe it's coding, you know. I mean, there's lots of different sorts of creativity, but I think we all need a language, and sometimes just, you know, verbal and words is not for everybody, I don't think. Some people want a more open-ended form of communication.
Gents, I'm going to jump into the conversation here very quickly. You've probably heard me mention that putting out a regular podcast involves a substantial investment of both time and money to make it happen. Guild of Dads isn't sponsored, and I'm 100% self-funded. So I've recently set up a service called Ko-Fi, which means that if you like and appreciate what I'm doing with Guild of Dads podcast and Facebook group, or even if you follow me on social media, then you can buy me a coffee to say thanks and support my work. Just head over to guildofdads.com and you will see a small coffee cup at the bottom left-hand side of the screen entitled Donate. You can also follow me on there, so I'll be posting updates and some other cool stuff just to let you know what I'm up to. Any of you guys helping to support the podcast and group by donating will get a shout-out on both platforms as my thanks to you for getting behind what I'm doing. On the 1st of November, I've something pretty special coming up, because that's when my Find Your Edge 28-day challenge starts, where over 4 weeks, I take a select group of dads on a journey of transformation that will teach you the most effective strategies I've learned to help you begin to live your life closer to the edge. I'm really excited about this one, because not only do I teach you everything I've learned since 2019 working with other men and dads, you get to cover creating a vision for your future, physical health and nutrition, mental health and mindset, and marriage and relationships. Not just that, but I have a dedicated personal trainer on hand throughout to help you hit the ground running on your physical health. To sign up, head on over to any of my social media platforms, click on the link in the bio or pinned post at the top, and jump on today. By the way, there's also an early bird offer running, so grab a special deal. If you hear this podcast later and have missed this advert, no sweat, just DM me, as I'm running these all the time on a regular basis. If you've ever wondered how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. That's dad in lowercase letters. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you'll be an amazing company. And now, back to today's conversation. Yeah, and I think the thing is most of us will have experienced this at some stage as well. I mean, and the thing is you know, we're touching on meaning quite a lot in this conversation. That's quite, as I said to you before we came on air, meaning in and of itself is quite a kind of metaphysical discussion anyway, in terms of like when I talk about kind of men and dads and this kind of the meaning crisis that people like Frankl and other authors really kind of delve into in the kind of modern world. The problem with it is that it's not like, you know, you can't say, oh, I'm lacking meaning in my life in the same way that you can as my arm hurts or, you know, I'm feeling depressed or whatever. It's a very abstract kind of thing in and of itself. And I think that I've, in the last little while, I'm not a psychologist, but I kind of researched a bit on metaphysics recently, because someone explained to me that metaphysics is kind of it's the stuff you can't put into words, that it's kind of, it's a feeling, it's a sense, it's a kind of, it's a very sort of abstract thing. And I was talking to some of the guys on my dad's group this week about it. You know, we were reviewing some of the different topics that we've covered in the last little while. And we were talking about this kind of, this notion that these shared experiences that we have, they're quite often you can't sort of say, you know, when you, for instance, some of the guys I'm working with, they're making some different changes in their lives, in different areas of their lives to improve different bits and bobs sort of thing. And I said to them, you know, you will find that it might not be that you can tangibly see these things on a kind of graph, you know, going like that, but you'll notice there'll be little signs happening around you. You know, your children will look at you differently. Your wife will hold you differently. People will react differently when you walk into a room, because nothing's changed about you physically, but there's a different aura. There's a different, and this is when you get into this kind of metaphysics of the stuff that, you know, you can't verbalize, but you know it's there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a difficult conversation for people to have, because we're so used to seeing stuff in writing or in kind of or depicted in some kind of communicable, if that is even a word, format. It becomes difficult. But like, you know, there's a really good people can look this up. It's on YouTube. There's an Eric Clapton. He performs "I Shot the Sheriff." I think it's a festival called Crossroads, I think, in the States somewhere. But there's a bit in where he does like the guitar solo and stuff. And the guitar solo bit goes on for like a minute and a half and whatever. But that bit in that whole 10-minute section, and there's a, you know, that solo for a minute or so, that just makes the hairs on the back of my neck go, because it's so haunting, the sound of this guitar music where he's just riffing by himself sort of thing. And it's those kind of, when we're talking about its creative process, it's that kind of stuff, isn't it? That you can't, I don't know why, but that just has an impact on me that other stuff might not, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But you see this in art, and you see this in music, both live music and also DJ'd music as well. Because I think that anyone that's ever been to like a concert or been to see a big DJ play, and you know they're mixing or they're doing whatever they're doing, and they just drop a note or they emphasize a bass line or something like that, it accentuates the kind of the meaning and the sort of, if you're with a load of other people, it's the kind of spiritual experience of being there. Not spiritual in a religious sense, but spiritual in being with a load of other people experiencing the same thing as they're experiencing in a different way at the same event.
Mm.
It's an interesting discussion. Do you think that, I notice that sometimes people have kind of creativity running through their veins richly as younger people, but they kind of lose it and then they kind of regain it, or they find that I'm not creative at all and I'm crap at drawing, or I've never played a musical instrument. Is there kind of some deficiency in that way of thinking?
Well, like I said, I think everyone is creative. I just think you've got to find your outlet, you know, and maybe you haven't found it. And I also think it's a mistake to think that I'm not good at it, so I shouldn't do it. Because, you know, a lot of us will say, well, I'm not very good. I mean, I can say I'm not a very good photographer, because I know what great photographers there are out there. And I know I'm not a shadow of what they are. But to only look up the ladder and go, wow, I've got a long way to go, so I must not be good, is foolish. Instead of saying, well, you know, I was rubbish and I've made some progress to being mediocre, and that's good. Like that's progress, and I'm enjoying the journey along the way. I think that's enough, you know. I think a lot of us, especially perfectionists, will be like, well, if I'm not the best at something, it's not worth doing it. Or I can't be bothered with it. And I understand that, because I am a perfectionist, but then you miss out on the joy of doing it, because you place such a high bar for yourself that says, if I'm not the best at it, I don't want to bother. What could you possibly ever enjoy? You know, it has to be for the process itself, and you don't have to be the best at it. You just have to get joy out of it, and you have to be willing to share it. That's enough, you know. It's not a competition.
Yeah. I think people paralyze themselves into thinking they've got to be perfect. And this is something I've suffered from, and I still do, even to this kind of, you know, even when I hit record button on a podcast, you know, you still think, oh, what if this happens, or what if that happens, or what if I say something stupid and stuff? And I think the thing is no one puts that kind of those layers of perfection on you like you do on yourself. And it's, you know, I delved into this with previous guests, that the kind of perfectionism used to be seen as kind of a virtue, but in actual fact, for a lot of people now, it's actually almost like a handicap, because it just talks you out of doing your greatest stuff. And, you know, we have a shared interest in Steve Pressfield, author of The War of Art, and I think it's Turning Pro or Going Pro. And, yeah, he talks about this notion of resistance, and that the biggest thing, usually the thing that is the most important thing for you to do, is the thing that is going to cause you the biggest amount of resistance as well. And this notion of getting out of your own way and stuff. And yeah, I have to kind of follow his advice on that. On a number of occasions I've had to do that. And it's the procrastination that you go through, isn't it? As a creative.
And I think perfectionism particularly is fear, really. I talk about it a little bit in the book, and you know, I say in there that you can immediately identify a perfectionist workspace if you walk in, because it's full of good work, and they'll usually quickly scrabble to hide it from you. And if you catch sight of somebody, you go, that's really good, you should show people. And they'll go, yeah, sure. But they'll hide it on a top shelf or throw it in a bin, and you'll never see it. Because their fear is, and I can say this because I'm this, you know, I'm talking about myself. Their fear is, my fear is that if I show this to the world and I think it's good and I've enjoyed making it, at that point I lose control of it. And now I might be ridiculed for it, or people might hate it. I might get criticized for it. A bunch of bad stuff could happen. A bunch of good stuff could happen. They could say, this is great, I love this, let me show it to my friends. But the opposite could happen. And the fear of the bad stuff happening, the fear of the criticism or the embarrassment or the shame or the whatever, stops us from showing it. So we work really, really hard to make brilliant work that we then hide away from everybody for fear of that bad result. That's perfectionism. And that's not helpful for anybody, because for us who are making things, I think if we're making something, how could we know how we're doing or shape what we're trying to do, or get feedback for it, or shape the message we're trying to put out in the world without that feedback loop? It's impossible. Our work won't develop as much as it could unless we do risk that stuff. And for the people out there who might experience it and get something good out of it, they'll never see it if my perfectionism wins. If I allow it to win, they don't get it. You know, yeah. So it's a crime across the board, and it's a battle worth fighting for sure.
Yeah. And it's finding the edge as well, because I think in this world as well, there's so much criticism about, and people are scared about putting themselves up for ridicule. But sometimes when I've sort of thought, is this sailing a bit close to the wind? The thing is that there are people who are sensationalists, who do stuff deliberately for a reaction all the time. And I think the thing is that in actual fact, it sometimes makes it more difficult if you want to push the boundaries or say something that is kind of a little bit controversial, because so many people now get shot down in flames for saying that, or for doing something that kind of slightly pushes the boundaries. I know sometimes on some of my social media content, I've been like, oh, shall I say that? Shall I not say that? And then I said it, and people have sometimes been like, thank Christ he said it. I'm glad you said it, because no one else will say it. And you're kind of just like, oh, all right. And maybe I just did hit a vein and hit a note there. But people are scared of that, I think, nowadays, with the kind of the trolling and the abuse that goes on. But you've got to have a lot of people for that kind of thing to go on. And in actual fact, a lot of the guys that I respect a massive amount in the kind of man and dad space, they know they're generally doing something right when they're pissing someone off. It's usually a sign that they're doing something wrong if they're not pissing anyone off, if that makes any sense. That does tend to happen. You talk about, in the context of your book, you talk about breath, and we've touched upon this as well. Do you find that breath helps you to kind of get present and get into the kind of creative flow that you need to get into?
I don't use it literally that much. I mean, only if I really get stuck, I think. Like, I understand, like, it's a big thing in meditation, but it's a big thing in meditation across the world in lots of different traditions, which means a lot of it's a human thing. It doesn't belong to any one tradition. We all worked this out different parts of the world thousands of years ago without comparing notes as human beings. So I think we worked out that we just need something simple to focus on, because our mind's running a mile a minute. So the best thing to do is, because we have to breathe, we can't stop doing that. That might be a good thing to focus on instead of our chattering mind. So, yeah, I mean, there are times when I use that in a more deliberate way, just to sort of take a bit of space, because I can't really shut my mind off. But more than that, I find walking to be the big one. So the way I like to take space personally is to go on a long walk, because I'm concentrating on not falling over, you know, like I'm concentrating where I'm stepping, and that while I'm doing that, you know, that's having the same effect of not concentrating on what my mind's buzzing away at and what's happening around me and how's the scenery changing. And I'll take a camera often and be taking photographs while I'm going as well, because that's something that's just a visual part of my brain I can let run, so that the subconscious part of my brain can run its script and work out the bugs, you know. So I find walking's a really good one for me.
And do you find that you beneficial for you to kind of go low tech when you're walking? Do you like just leave your phone at home and just take the camera out with you, or do you find that it's easier?
No, I don't mind taking my phone with me. I often listen to podcasts or listen to music. When I'm walking, I'm a fan of soundtracks. So I've got like an ambient soundtrack playlist on Spotify that I put together. I really like that stuff. No, I don't mind something like that. But I can also tell when it's time to take the headphones out and just be in that space with the audio as well and cut off the phone. But no, I mean I've got enough self-discipline, I think, that I can be out and about and know what the moment requires. If I'm going out, like I used to do a lot of street photography in London, and some days I go out and walk around for 4 or 5 hours. So I knew some of that time I was going to listen to soundtracks and just have a think. Some of that time I was going to take headphones out and listen to what's going on around me, a bit more present with the photography side. And sometimes I've got a long stretch ahead of me where I've got to go make a bus, but I'm going to have to move quite quickly. I'll stick a podcast in. You know, I don't need to kind of leave the phone at home. I can sort of, I know what each moment needs. It's just making sure you get deliberate about taking that space when you need it, you know, and because the addiction, and it's being aware of the addiction with the phone as well. Like if you're aware of it, I think you can do things to say, well, that's not the right time for that. That sometimes takes a little bit to work out and see your own addiction to devices that you just pick up to fill a gap. But it's a good thing to do because, I mean, they're amazing tools as well. Like, I think we've got this like either or mentality where we're like, well, the phones are evil. We've got to cut them out of our lives, or we're absolutely addicted to the phone and we can't put it down. Instead of going, this thing's an amazing tool to use for a bunch of different things, but it has its place and learning where its place is so that we can pick it up and use it for great stuff when we want to, and then put it away and focus on more important things when we don't, and create those deliberate spaces, I think, is a good discipline to have, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean on that because, funny enough, I've started my kids growing up very, very quick now, and my youngest, she's different to my eldest in that my youngest is the right kind of poser. She will strike a pose, and so she was like standing at the office door here this afternoon, and she was sort of leaning against the door, and she just. The sort of light from the other room was kind of catching, and I thought that just looks really good. So I said, "Wait, just wait there a minute." And so I quickly grabbed my phone, flipped it into black and white mode, and snapped a photo of her in black and white. And then she looked the other way, and I quickly snapped a photo of her in color, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's those kind of things that you probably, like, if I didn't have the phone sitting on my desk,
yeah,
I probably wouldn't have captured that moment that she was sort of standing there, sort of thing. So. And I seem to be taking a lot of photos on my phone in black and white at the minute. I don't know why, but I just seem to quite like black and white. But again, you can't do that if you've not got a phone in your pocket that you can quickly flick it across to do that. So
I think we blame phones and social media for a lot, but it's not their fault. It's our fault. Like, we shouldn't be pointing the phone going, phones are evil or social media is evil. No, you're using them badly. It's just a tool. Like, oh, Instagram's ruining my life. No, you're addicted to it, and it's your choices that are ruining your life. It's not Instagram's fault. You can't blame the company for producing a product you got hooked on. It's at some point, it's your responsibility to admit you have a problem, to 12-step that stuff, you know, admit you have a problem and start to make decisions against having that in your life. The way that it is, it's all down to, I'm a big one on like personal responsibility. I just think it's lazy to blame the device or to blame the platform. If we're, you know, and that's for those of us who are fully fledged adults who have to take responsibility for our decisions, maybe not kids and other situations, but yeah, for an adult, it's definitely our job to work out where that fits and where it doesn't, you know?
Yeah, I find myself logging off is the easiest way to do it, actually. So
yeah,
logging off and having a very difficult password that you can't remember in order to log back on again. That seems to kind of crack it for me, and having it in another room. But I like Atomic Habits. I like the techniques he talks about in that, actually. So we've sort of talked about a number of different things in relation to meaning. And also how people can get into and try out different things, and if they don't think that they're creative, to actually get in the habit of kind of trying stuff out and failing it. There's a sort of a number of different chapters in your book, and I know that I can see that they kind of delve into the kind of fears and beliefs that we have about ourselves in terms of trying new things. In terms of like, we've talked about fear and perfectionism. Do you think in some respects, kind of fully harnessing the sort of creative process, we need to actually cede a bit of control in order to gain a bit of control, i.e. actually allow ourselves to make mistakes and allow ourselves to be a bit shit at stuff before we actually can begin to derive a bit of meaning from the process of actually trying new things and being creative, giving ourselves a bit more permission on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the creative process, isn't it, to experiment. And you can't experiment and expect perfect results. Experiments mean most of it's going to come out crap and little bits of it will work, and that's how we learn. So yeah, I think it's not just engaging in a creative outlet, it's engaging in a creative way with that creative outlet. And that means lots of trial and error. I mean, the famous one is Henri Cartier-Bresson, who's like a famous street photographer. He said, your first 10,000 photographs are your worst. And it was like him saying, listen, you're going to have to produce a mountain of shite before you get to the good stuff. That's how this works. You can't skip to the good stuff. You can't take a camera out and become a brilliant photographer on day one unless you're some kind of phenom. And most of us are definitely not. So strap in and make a lot of rubbish. And through that, you will see glimmers of something start to emerge that you're going to piece together over years and years until something good starts to come through. That's how it works for all of us. If we approach it with this kind of entitled mentality of, yeah, but I drew three pictures and they weren't brilliant. They're not going up in a gallery. Well, of course not. Like, produce 10,000, then there's talk. You know, this is a long road for any of us, and you're going to have to get used to failure, and you're going to have to learn to enjoy the process even on the frustrating days, knowing that you are moving somewhere the whole time, even on days that feel like setbacks, maybe especially on days that feel like setbacks, because those are the days you probably learn the most, even though they feel rubbish at the time. It's all journey stuff, you know.
Yeah, and I think the thing is as well is I think in this current day and age, people see stuff, you know, there's always this whole thing about overnight success that took like 10 years sort of thing. But I think people really do see that now, and they see these people that their perception is that they are overnight success, but in actual fact, they actually have only known of them overnight. But in actual fact, they've been doing that for a number of years, you know, gradually getting better and better at it. And yeah, I can relate to that, because as you know, like you said, there's days where you just think, why am I doing this? What's the point? It's all going to shit. All of my tech is going wrong, and it's just like the gods are conspiring against me to completely fuck up what I'm doing today. And it's like, but you're right. Those are the days where you just have to keep going, and then all of a sudden, what I often find, and this is like the, you know, Pressfield would call this the muses. It's kind of like often. You will have a really difficult period before you hit a kind of turning point. Mm-hmm. It's always like that's like, if you can imagine the kind of steps going up, it's always that really steep bit. And then all of a sudden it plateaus out and you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going up a little bit now sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But you think it's linear, but it's not. It's kind of it's like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Snakes and ladders.
Yeah, it is. It's a frustrating situation to be in. We've delved into a ton of stuff in tonight's conversation. It's been really interesting kind of picking your brains in this abstract area between, you know, creativity and meaning and how we can really begin to kind of harness this. What is the best way for people to find out about you, and when does your book come out, and how can people get hold of it and stuff, Sean?
Easiest way to find me, if you just go onto YouTube, you find my channel just with my name, Sean Tucker, S-E-A-N-T-U-C-K-E-R. The book, you should be able to find anywhere you buy books. So if you go onto Amazon or Waterstones or Foils or Barnes & Noble or wherever you are, just search for The Meaning in the Making, Sean Tucker. It should be there. It comes out on August 10th worldwide. So all digital copies will be available on that day, but there are some delays in shipping to the UK and Europe. So it looks like at the moment, UK physical books are more on track for middle of September. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you can go along and pre-order in the meantime. And it'll get delivered to you as soon as it's available. But yeah, all digital Kindle versions and all that sort of stuff will be out August 10th. And anyone, US and Canada, should get their books very soon after that. And then the rest of the world, it's going to filter out. It's just, COVID and Suez Canal backups and Chinese port issues. It's all the world's going through a bit of a rough one. But it'll get there, you know.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Well, I'm really looking forward to it. I've got mine on pre-order. So it's definitely a book that I'm going to be kind of delving into and probably with my yellow highlighter pen, making loads of highlighter notes on it and sub notes and all that good stuff and whatever. So I'm going to ask you one more question, which you won't be surprised by, but and I don't prime any of the guests on this podcast for it. Sean, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
I mean, I'll give you what I said in the book, you know, because it's true for me. It's where I got it from. I live by a quote that I heard years ago when I worked for the church by a guy named Frederick Buechner. And he sort of talks about it more in a sort of churchy language, but I mean, it applies to me now as much as it ever did, even though I don't attend a church or anything. And he said, your calling is found in the place where your deep joy and the world's deep hunger collide. And I love that idea. And I think, you know, in my life, it's those two things. It's, I need to work out what my deep joy is. I need to work out, what do I do that makes me lose track of time, that gives me a good night's sleep at the end of the day, that energizes me, that doesn't take energy from me. And for me, that is taking photographs, shooting portraits especially. It is making films and talking to people and inspiring them. It is writing this book and getting this out there, hoping that it will do some good. And that's joy for me. That's the half the equation. The other half is where the world's deep hunger is. And I hope that everything I put out to the world, whether it's portraits with people, I just took a portrait of someone this week who sent me a long email afterwards telling me, you know, I've had body image issues for 10 years. And I saw these pictures come through and just burst into tears in the kitchen because I actually liked what I saw. Now, for me, that's my deep joy in taking portraits and the world's deep hunger in her going, I don't like myself. I don't like how I look. And it's something I do that brings me joy, helping somewhere in the world that's a bit hungry. That's meaning for me. That's everything. That's all of the equation. That's me doing something I love and making something in the world just a little bit better is everything. And there are 1,000 ways I can do that. And I'm trying to find them all the time. Making the films that I make on YouTube, you know, I might throw out a video that I don't think is means very much, but then I get a long email saying, I was really struggling today. I didn't really have any direction. And that video just helped me go, okay, good. I can pick myself up. That's my deep joy, hitting someone else's deep hunger in that moment, going, I don't know what my meaning is or purpose. I don't have any direction, that they pick up from that. Writing this book is probably the biggest thing I've done in the last 10 years that has the potential to do that. I got a lot of joy out of writing it, and I'm glad I did. And even if no one read it, I would feel very satisfied with having written it. It was really cathartic. But that's only half of it. Now it gets released. Hopefully a bunch of people read it, and it feeds a lot of their deep hunger. And I think that's a challenge for anybody, is like, work out those two things. What is your deep joy? What is it that brings you deep joy? And then how can you point that at something in the world that's hungry or broken or missing or disconnected that you can make just a tiny bit better? And I promise you, meaning will be there on a plate for you. It's all there. You don't need anything else.
I love it. I really like that. I really like it a lot. And that does resonate. And I think that will resonate with a lot of people that are listening or watching this, because I think it's very powerful. And I've heard a kind of variation of that before as well. I do like it a lot. Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, and on a topic that, as I mentioned to you before, is kind of captivates me. I could spend hours talking about it, and it always puts a smile on my face, and that is a subject of meaning. So thank you very much, sir. I wish you all the best with the book, and I hope it's a great success, and I'm really pleased that it's been such a fantastic experience for you actually doing it as well. So all the best on that, man.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
A big thanks to Sean for joining me. There are a few places you can check him out. We mentioned his YouTube channel. Just search up Sean Tucker. His website is seantucker.photography, and over on Instagram, he's at Sean Tuck. All of those platforms display some of the work that he does, and it is truly amazing. Today's episode was really interesting, not least because of my interest in the subject of meaning anyway, but what I really liked was that this is one of those things we instinctively know. We know that there is something we feel in the creative and making process, no matter what it is worth making. I think that there is a lot of power in how Sean has been able to articulate this in his book. If you want to link up with me, you can do so on Instagram or Facebook using the handle @GuildofDads. Let me know what resonated with you about this episode. I'm doing a lot more on Twitter at the minute, funnily enough. So you can also link up with me on Twitter. Let me know what resonated you about this episode. I'd really like to know what you like to create that gives you meaning. Did I mention that you can now buy me a coffee on my website, guildofdads.com? It's really easy and helps keep the lights on here at Guild of Dads Towers. So a big shout out goes to Warren Forsyth, Steve Miller, and Martin MacGyver, all of whom have dropped me a donation recently. Thank you, gents. In order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves, inspire others. Share this podcast with others so that they may benefit from anything you have found useful or interesting. And gents, this is as easy as hitting the share button, putting in the names of five other men and saying, hey, check this out. Use the hashtag Guild of Dads on social media and tag me in. I will shout you out on here. The other thing you can do is leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, which really helps other dads to find the podcast. Right now, the Guild of Dads Facebook group is growing fast, very fast, in fact. If you want to get on board, head over to there and join up today, where you can get around a lively group of other guys talking everything about being a dad and improving themselves as men and dads. Hopefully, you find something insightful in every episode, so share with dads you know. In the meantime, live a life of vision, action, and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.